The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right. Well, thanks for coming to this session. It might be the first ever talk about infrastructure at a socialism conference. Not sure, though, so don't quote me on that. So before I get into the talk, I'd just like to raise a caveat. I mean, first of all, infrastructure is enormous. Infrastructure systems, and they play a huge role in the everyday workings of society. The unfortunate side of it is that there isn't a whole lot written about infrastructure. And if you can imagine, if there isn't a whole lot written in general about infrastructure, there isn't really a lot written from a Marxist understanding of infrastructure either. So, and the idea of it being pretty broad, like each one of the infrastructure systems could probably use its own talk. So I just want to say that this, maybe we can treat this as kind of a preliminary sketch or a starting point, and then folks in the discussion can raise things. I will inevitably miss some important points and things in this talk, and maybe folks can raise those points and maybe even clarify some issues that I raise in the talk. So because I think that as socialists, we do need to actually have an understanding of infrastructure under capitalism, and also like what do we want to see as far as in a post-revolutionary society, an infrastructure system that serves the work, the needs of the vast majority instead of the tiny minority. So with that, I'll get on with my talk. And as the talk implies, there's a crisis in infrastructure in the U.S. And for those of you who've read about the infrastructure crisis, one of the most quoted groups is the American Society of Civil Engineers. Their latest report card that they issue every 4 years gives the U.S. a cumulative grade of D+. And this is up from a solid D in 2009 from their report card. So it's hardly something to feel confident about that it's been up half a letter grade. Additionally, the U.S. Department of Transportation, the DOT, has found that 1 in 4 bridges in the U.S. are either structurally deficient or not designed for the level of traffic that they currently support. And some of you might remember back in 2007 when the Interstate 35W bridge in Minneapolis, Minnesota collapsed, killing 13 people and injuring 145. Well, before the collapse, the bridge was rated both structurally deficient as well as fractal critical, which means that the failure of one component of the bridge could cause the total collapse of the bridge. This is what they knew before the collapse of the 35W bridge. Airport facilities in the U.S. are also overburdened, with 20% of all arrivals and departures delayed, according to the DOT. And anyone who's flown in or out of O'Hare probably knows what they're talking about. The subway system in New York City suffers from chronic delays and disrepair facilities and an antiquated signal system that's left over from like the 1920s or 30s, from what I've read. Apparently there are horror stories of debris burning on the rail and trail derailments, so that's what commuters have to endure in New York City. And vulnerable communities are oftentimes the most affected by infrastructure failure, like in Flint, Michigan, which is a majority African-American city. Lead contamination was discovered in Flint's drinking water in 2014 after an unelected emergency manager switched the water supply from Detroit's water system to the corrosive water of the Flint River in a cost-cutting effort, which leached the lead from the pipes and into the water flow. And when tested, Flint's water had lead levels at over 2.5 times what would be considered hazardous waste, leading to elevated lead levels in Flint residents. What became clear after Flint was that the crisis in drinking water in the U.S. was not just limited to this city. While the U.S. has banned lead pipes in water systems back in the 1980s, there's still up to 10 million lead pipes in use in water systems throughout the U.S. In fact, in the wake of the Flint crisis, at least 278 schools were found to have unsafe levels of lead in their drinking water. And I did a Google search of schools and lead in water, and there's a whole bunch of other ones. So I think that 278 is actually a pretty low estimate, because I think there's been more discovery of lead in drinking water in schools. I know Portland has a couple of schools that have lead in their drinking water that we discovered last summer. And it was just reported last week that between 2012 and 2016, 820 children under the age of 6 living in New York City public housing tested positive for lead poisoning. Indigenous peoples in the U.S. are facing their own infrastructure-related water crisis with the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access oil pipelines that violate their national sovereignty by crossing their lands and threatening their water supply with toxic oil spills. And the oil flowing through these pipelines further accelerates climate change when combusted and drives the hurricanes and superstorms that wreak havoc on some of the most vulnerable populations in the U.S. Last summer, Hurricane Maria ripped through Puerto Rico, taking out the electrical grid and the water supply system on an island that's been long devastated by racist and colonial policies forced upon the Puerto Rican people by U.S. and financial oligarchs. And electrical grids on the mainland are in bad shape too, as more than 70% of the transformers and lines across the U.S. are 25 years old, and weather-related power outages have become 10 times more frequent since the 1980s. And as of 2025, 70% of the country's 90,580 dams will be over 50 years old, which is beyond the average lifespan of most dams. In these instances, in these incidents and statistics just scratch the surface of the crisis in U.S. infrastructure and its human toll, particularly on people of color, poor people, and workers. And the idea that our infrastructure failing is not a new concept either. In fact, in 1981, a report was released by the Council of State Planning Agencies entitled America in Ruins, which spoke to the issue of underfunded public facilities that were wearing out faster than they could be replaced. This was followed up in 1988 by a report from the Congressionally Chartered National Council on Public Works Improvement, which stated, "Our infrastructure is inadequate to sustain a stable and growing economy," and issued a letter grade for 8 infrastructure categories, with highways receiving the highest score of C+. And since 1998, the American Society of Civil Engineers, which I was talking about before, has released a report card every 4 years since, indicting U.S. infrastructure as woefully inadequate. And all this said, it's pretty clear that the U.S. is facing a crisis in infrastructure, and politicians from across the spectrum tend to agree with this, including Trump. So if there's a general consensus that the U.S.'s infrastructure is crumbling, why hasn't there been anything done to solve this? So I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about infrastructure and capitalism, because I think understanding the roles in which different infrastructure systems play under capitalism can help us to better understand the crisis in infrastructure and why the crisis exists. And I think Marx's writing on capitalism can help to serve as a framework for this understanding, at least partially. I do want to make clear that the development of infrastructure does not simply happen according to the dictates of the capitalist system. I'd argue that it's contested terrain, which means that mass social struggles can have an impact on infrastructure, what is built, what is not built, and to whose interests it actually serves. So Marx and Engels lived in a time where systems of what we would now call infrastructure were in the process of being revolutionized. They witnessed the birth of the railroad and the application of the steam engine to sea and land travel, which greatly reduced the time that products and people could travel across long distances. And they also saw the implementation of the telegraph, which allowed for communication to reach places thousands of miles away in a matter of hours. And Marx studied these systems and networks within the movement of capital and the broader dynamics of capitalism. He understood that unlike the previous class systems, where communication and transport were somewhat peripheral and inconsistent, and tended to develop in accordance with the relative greed or ambition of the ruling or merchant classes, under capitalism, these systems became crucial to the constant drive for profits and accumulation inherent within capitalism. To quote Marx, "The more production comes to rest on exchange value, hence on exchange, the more important do the physical conditions of exchange, the means of communication and transport, become for the cost of circulation. Capital by its nature drives beyond every spatial barrier. Thus, the creation of the physical conditions of exchange, of the means of communication and transport, the annihilation of space by time becomes an extraordinary necessity for it." So we can see here an important relationship between production and circulation, where advances in the methods of production necessitate advances in transportation and in communication, and vice versa. In the Second Industrial Revolution, which was in full swing at this time, was a major contributor to the advances in technology driving production, transportation, and communication. Marx is more explicit with this relationship elsewhere when he states that the revolution in the modes of production of industry and agriculture made necessary a revolution in the general conditions of the social process of production, i.e., in the means of communication and transport. And going back to the previous quote, Marx's idea of the annihilation of space by time is a helpful one in understanding communication and transport under capitalism. With the rise of manufacturing and eventually industrial production comes the need for fast and dependable supplies of, dependable systems of supply and distribution. Capitalism is constantly striving to expand beyond its previous borders and reduce the distribution times and costs of raw materials, finished goods, and people. And the means of communication, like the telegraph of Marx and Engels' time, have been crucial to continue and continue to be more and more critical for coordinating the movement of capital across space. And this brings us to like the logistics revolution of today, where just-in-time production requires highly time-sensitive and dependent communication in order to facilitate it. And so, from the early 16th century to 1840, you have essentially horse-drawn wagons and sailing ships that average about 10 miles an hour. Once you reach 1850, you have the revolution with steam transport, where steamships can go about 35 miles an hour and rail can go about 65 miles an hour, and you continue to have that revolution in speed of transportation up until the present day. As Marxist geographer David Harvey explains, physical space in itself does not matter for capital. All that capital cares about is the cost and the time of movement, and it will do everything in its power to seek to minimize these costs and times and reduce spatial barriers to movement. To do this, it must radically and continuously revolutionize space relations. So in the eyes of capitalism, you can essentially decrease the distance between places by just reducing the time it takes to get from one place to the other. The faster that commodities reach their destination, the faster that capitalists complete that circuit of production and pocket the profit. And the lower the cost of transportation and distribution, the greater the amount of money the capitalists can reap in the end. And various infrastructure systems and networks have been key to facilitating this revolution and movement, from railroads to seaports to airports to highway systems and to telecommunications networks. And the arrival of the railroad in the US provides a good example of this. In the latter third of the 19th century, the development of the railroad in the US, particularly the transcontinental railroads that connected eastern cities with the West Coast, had a huge impact on the economy as well as the US's place in the world economically. Canadian socialist Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin explain this period. With the completion of the Continental Railroad and the new communications technology, they're talking about they're basically stringing telegraph lines along the rail alignments. American companies had moved from local, state, and regional sales to marketing their products nationwide and soon also began marketing and producing internationally too. As Mira Wilkins has demonstrated, the American companies with national sales plans and unique products discovered the attractions of doing business abroad and were the first to be successful in undertaking such activities. Singer, Edison, Westinghouse, Eastman Kodak, General Electric, National Cash Register, Otis Elevator, and International Harvester, not to mention Standard Oil, were among the first multinational corporations spreading the inventions, technologies, and commodities of the American Industrial Revolution abroad. So the creation of the railroads, by reducing the time it takes to travel from one point to another, facilitated the expansion of markets for US businesses, setting them up to eventually become the first international corporations. And the telegraph lines along the tracks facilitated the distribution of these goods with an efficiency that no previous technology could match. And it's important to note that the land grants in the US government handed over to the rail barons at this time to build the transcontinental rails resulted in one of the largest acts of land theft against indigenous people. So the creation of these lines fits neatly within the logic of capitalist expansion and the racist ideology of manifest destiny. And 10,000 Chinese and 3,000 Irish workers faced the inhumane conditions of laying track on the railroad. For the railroad during this time, the number of deaths for workers laying track equaled the total number of combat deaths in the Civil War, according to Steve Talbot, the author of The Roots of Oppression. This illustrates the US state actively laying the groundwork for economic growth and opening up new areas of stolen land for accumulation on the backs of the working class and the genocide of native peoples. all of which helped to pave the path for U.S. dominance in the decades to follow. And I think it's, I won't get to this, but it's interesting to see China's One Belt, One Road infrastructure program and understand that the idea of infrastructure imperialism is still inextricably linked as China seeks to expand its sphere of influence. So before we turn to another aspect of infrastructure, it's important to mention a few more ways in which the means of communication serve capitalists. One is which money in its non-material form, once you have the telegraph and you have faster means of telecommunications, investment it can flow much faster from one part of the world to another. So capitalism can exploit places where it feels it can reap a lot of profits through investment. The other way is that capitalists seek to dominate the means of communication. So they're not just trying to facilitate coordination between themselves and compete between themselves, but they're also using communication technologies to enforce the ruling ideas upon the working class as well. So they want to dominate those ideas. And that brings up issues of net neutrality that we seek today, I mean, amongst media consolidation and other things that we deal with as political issues today. So we've talked about transportation and communication and the important role that they play in the circuit of production, but what about other infrastructure systems? So Marx wrote quite a bit about the production process and the circulation of commodities. And the infrastructure systems like water and wastewater networks and electrical grids and gas networks are certainly important in workplaces and the broader production process, and Marx would consider these factors, most of these factors of production. But these systems are also linked directly to most homes in the US, and workers regularly use them as part of replenishing their ability to work on a daily basis, which is an aspect of what Marxists would call social reproduction. Marx explains the importance of workers' labor by saying, "The maintenance and reproduction of the working class remains a necessary condition for the reproduction of capital." In other words, if workers can't work, capitalism can't function. And while Marx didn't write nearly as much about this sphere of capitalism, we can draw from the social reproduction theorists who have built upon his writings and expand an understanding of how workers reproduce their ability to work, or labor power, as Marx would call it, and how infrastructure influences that and social reproduction relies on infrastructure. So Tithi Bhattacharya, the editor of Social Reproduction Theory, begins her book by raising a series of questions. If workers' labor produces all the wealth in society, who then produces the worker? Put another way, what kind of processes enable the worker to arrive at the doors of her place of work every day so that she can produce the wealth of society? What role did breakfast play in her work readiness? What about the public transportation system that helped bring her to work, or to the public parks and libraries that provide recreation so that she can be regenerated again to be able to come to work? These questions all raise issues of workers being able to reproduce their labor power, and we can see infrastructure systems embedded in all these questions. It's important to keep in mind that the lion's share of this work is unfortunately still shouldered by women and femmes, both within and outside of the household. And so households need power to cook food, for workers to run their appliances and heat their homes, as well as to drink potable water and wash clothes. So electrical grids, natural gas networks, and water systems are all important to this circuit of reproduction. Workers also need a way to get to their jobs, so we need roads or highways to get to it via car or bike, or we need to take mass transit, right? Bus or subway or commuter rail, the latter two which require tracks. And we often rely on telecommunications like the internet and telephone service to keep in touch with family and friends and to coordinate our daily schedules. So infrastructure underpins a lot of the important aspects of workers' social reproduction as well. And it would be interesting, this is a point where hopefully, you know, it would be nice if people brought up in the discussion, but it'd be interesting to know how infrastructure systems have reduced labor time. I mean, as opposed to like, say, someone having to go to the public pump every day, you have water instantaneously every time you turn on the tap. Things like electricity provide the ability to have vacuum cleaners, washing machines, things like that. There's actually a really good chapter in the book on social reproduction theory that talks about in the 60s and the 70s how labor-saving appliances changed sort of the division of labor, not only gender-wise, but also racially by saving labor time in the sphere of social reproduction and allowing a lot of women actually into the workforce. But it also stratifies, of course, according to racial lines. So All right, so I'm going to switch gears because there's a lot more that could be said about this, but I only have 40 minutes to talk. So why is there a crisis? If infrastructure underpins so many aspects of capitalism and capitalism depends on it, why are we in a crisis? Wouldn't the logical thing for the ruling classes do to be to just sort of bite the bullet and figure out what it needs to do to repair the aging systems and things like that? And I think I have a way to understand this contradiction. I'll argue that the crisis is the result of the neoliberal restructuring that took place in the US over the past four decades. So neoliberalism rose to prominence as a response to the global economic crisis in the early 70s that the Keynesian government spending measures were incapable of solving. By launching a full-scale attack on workers, instituting massive tax cuts for the rich and corporations, gutting social programs, deregulating, privatizing, all of this led to profitability being reestablished for the capitalist class, thanks to these neoliberal policies. But these same policies that restored growth for US capitalists, albeit on the backs of the workers and poor, also have a contradictory character to them. And I think that Scottish Marxist Neil Davidson's analysis is helpful in understanding this contradiction. Davidson explains that with the rise of neoliberalism, the managers of the capitalist state, who aren't actually the capitalists themselves, rather than serving the broader and longer term interests of capitalism as a whole, as they tended to do in the previous period under Keynesian regimes, begin to serve the immediate and narrow interests of capitalism, even when these interests undermine the maintenance of the capitalist system itself. Davidson puts it this way: neoliberal regimes have increasingly abandoned any attempt to arrive at an overarching understanding of what the conditions for growth might be, other than the supposed need for lowering taxation and regulation and raising labor flexibility. And he continues on to say, insofar as there's a strategic view, it involves avoiding any policies which might incur corporate displeasure, however minor the inconveniences they might involve for the corporations. So while these neoliberal policies may serve the narrow interests of capitalists in the here and now, they actually undermine the broader prospects for future growth under capitalism in some ways. And I think that this argument helps to explain the illogical crisis of infrastructure. While infrastructure is critical to the capitalist system as a whole, as we've just discussed, capitalists don't necessarily want to have their tax raised in order to fit the bill, and the state doesn't appear to be going against their wishes anytime soon. So we're left in this, we're sort of left with this wait until it fails strategy, which is what happens right now. But I think there's more to the argument than this, because infrastructure systems have been built throughout the neoliberal period. In fact, like, there's been a lot of money spent to actually increase the height of rail tunnels in order to double stack containers on rail. The Panama Canal has been expanded to send super huge ships through that are containing containers. And all of this actually requires the raising of bridges as well, not raising and down, but actually raising elevation-wise, of bridges to actually fit these super ships through. So there is money spent, but I'm actually going to go a slightly different direction on this as well. So there is money spent, but what tends to be also different about the systems of infrastructure that have been constructed since the 80s is that they've been constructed in locationally specific enclaves that serve only a narrow layer of the rich and powerful while bypassing working and poor people. And the ultimate goal of these small projects, well, they don't necessarily need to be small, but they're locationally specific, they're isolated, is to create places of high-end consumption and recreation, or globally competitive zones in finance, technology, manufacturing, or logistics that are furnished with high-performance infrastructure networks, oftentimes disintegrated from the previous built broad infrastructure systems that were created primarily from the 1930s to the 1960s. Those are the ones that are sort of crumbling right now. At the same time, state institutions are often leveraged to alter or strip existing regulations for these enclaves and offer tax breaks, public funding, and other incentives for investment. So contrary to the idea that neoliberalism is a retreat of state action in favor of market forces, the state is actually a key player in fostering the development of these zones of high-performance infrastructure. And these projects are designed to maximize profit for investors and corporations while avoiding the cost of providing any services for the working class and poor people. Sometimes this entails privatization of public infrastructure or the initiation of public-private partnerships. And I don't have a ton of time to go into public-private partnerships, but I should probably say a couple things about them. I'll just refer to them as P3s. They're agreements where private investors or companies agree to fund and take on government-initiated projects for a return in the level of control over the project and the ability to generate returns on the investment. And usually this comes through like service fees or tolls. So if you ride a highway, that's a P3, it's bound to be a toll road, and you're going to pay a toll in order to fund the project. The government entity is oftentimes saddled with all the financial risk if the project goes south, so it's actually really nice for investors. And regular working people will be hit with the fees when it's completed. And P3s are also known for their lack of public input or accountability. These types of projects have become popular with the rise of neoliberalism as a way to incorporate the logic of the capitalist market into various aspects of governance. So the ideas of maybe cutting corners around materials, making workers work harder and faster for less, lean production, things like that. And this can actually fit into it. I didn't really read anything about it, but this could actually fit into why infrastructure collapses, because it's not just old infrastructure collapsing, like the Miami pedestrian bridge that collapsed last year was actually a pretty new infrastructure. So it could be some of these, the market logic of cutting costs and making workers work harder for less, that could lead to these failures as well. So one example of these exclusive developments includes financial centers that have a premium telecommunication infrastructure network set to receive up to the millisecond information on market conditions and capital flows. And there are also resort enclaves and high-end gated communities that host their own assortment of exclusive infrastructure systems. In Naomi Klein's new book, The Battle for Paradise, we can get a glimpse of the exclusive enclave for rich tax dodgers that wealthy investors want to develop in Puerto Rico. She says, post-Maria, with land selling for even cheaper, public assets being auctioned at fire sale prices, and billions in federal disaster funds flowing to contractors, some distinctly more grandiose dreams for the island have begun to surface. Now, rather than shopping for mansions and resort communities, the Puertopians, and that's what she calls the investors that want to sort of invade Puerto Rico with their money and development, are looking to buy a piece of land large enough to start their very own city, complete with airport, yacht port, passport, all run on virtual currencies. And I can imagine that they'll try and find a way to make sure that they have their own separate electrical grid, broadband, and water system too, to avoid having to deal with any of the issues that regular Puerto Ricans have had to endure. Another one of these types of exclusive infrastructure forms is the creation of a high-end districts of consumption, usually really close to a city's downtown. And these are sometimes referred to as business improvement districts, or BIDs. Sorry for the acronyms. It's in one of the quotes. That's the only reason why I'm using it. Urban scholar Stephen Grams describes the BID as a tailor-made form of local government. BIDs essentially involve the collaboration of local property capital to take control over a range of local municipal functions for their own private urban patch. Such services encompass street cleaning, street lighting, public space management, garbage removal, public works, private policing, and environmental improvements and marketing. The areas representing the inner 7.2 miles of Detroit, now known as the New Detroit, is an illustrative example of Graham's description of this type of exclusive high-end consumption form of infrastructure development. New Detroit, which is a rich and largely white enclave in the center of the city, began to emerge after the city's bankruptcy in 2013, which put the city under an emergency manager like Flint, who cut city workers' pensions, slashed city services, and leveraged tax breaks and subsidies to make the city attractive to investors. But even before the fiscal crisis, city officials were planning on directing the lion's share of city funds to the downtown and an adjacent mixed-use development rebranded in the early 2000s as Midtown, while neglecting struggling neighborhoods. After the bankruptcy, a $650 million development plan was launched, giving developers the opportunity to purchase vacant or neglected buildings and turn them into high-end retail and luxury flats. Along with this came hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks and incentives to bring in large companies and investors. And the infrastructure came as well, with the development of a bike and walking path that spans the western side of downtown and its eastern edge, and the M1 rail, a 3.2-mile trolley that connects Detroit's downtown to Midtown exclusively. Along with the M1's construction came speculators that bought up real estate along the trolley stops to build high-end apartments. Journalist Peter Moskowitz has this to say about the trolley. The M1 is a good example of the modus operandi of Detroit's development these days. Touted as good for the public, planned by a confluence of powerful nonprofits that have little accountability to Detroiters, and funded by and largely for the benefit of the city's most powerful companies. In fact, the new Detroit even has its own private security force that coordinates with Detroit police and monitors downtown to minimize the disturbance of low-level offenses, which would be something that, you know, high-end consumers wouldn't want to deal with. And while the gentrified inner ring of Detroit has a $10 million budget for planning their little island of a city, the rest of Detroit, which is largely African American, suffers from no streetlights, irregular garbage service, and the constant threat of water shutoffs from the water utility, all while paying ridiculously high property taxes on houses that are worth a small fraction of their former value, forcing many of the homeowners into foreclosure. So this is just a glimpse of what this form of the type of exclusionary infrastructure development looks like, and we can see similar forms to this in cities gentrifying across the U.S. I mean, Portland's a big case of that too, where there's a business, they don't call it a bid, but you have that sort of outer gentrification that displaces people to the margins because of all that investment. And then they have three streetcar lines, but none of them leave the central city. And there are other examples of premium infrastructure enclaves in the creation of science and technology parks, often developed around universities, as well as logistics hubs on the fringes of major metropolitan regions, like Chicago, which is a huge logistics hub. And Trump's infrastructure plan that he proposed earlier this year just stands to accelerate this model of exclusive infrastructure development if it were to be passed into law at some point. But this doesn't look really likely at this point. Not only does this plan roll back important environmental regulations, it also seeks to privatize a set of public institutions like Ronald Reagan and the Dulles Airports, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and the Bonneville Power Administration. And it encourages public-private partnerships by offering tax-exempt bond financing and requiring money-starved city and state governments to come up with 80% of the funding for the projects. In true to P3 fashion, the projects most likely to be implemented are the ones that are going to yield the most significant returns for investors, while projects that would serve poor and working class communities would be left behind. And while Trump's plan's clearly pretty awful, I think we need to also oppose the policies of some liberal politicians that aim to fund infrastructure with sales and gas taxes too. These flat taxes place a disproportionate burden on working class and poor people, especially gas taxes, which weigh heavier on those that have been displaced to the margins of the city and are more reliant on automobile transportation. We need to make the rich pay for quality infrastructure that is built in the interests of the majority of people and not the rich and powerful. And I'll just conclude with some of these last things that I say. And I think to do this, we'll need to reverse the 40-year legacy of neoliberalism that has starved those at the bottom of society in order to lavish those at the top. And this will require building a left that has the politics that can win struggles and bring in broader layers of people who want to fight for a better world. And an important part of this struggle has to be supporting the rights of all oppressed people to self-determination, from the water protectors at Standing Rock to the Puerto Rican people. Racism and other oppressions are reinforced by infrastructure in the broader built environment, so we need to pose solutions that address the current and the historic legacies of oppression. It was black neighborhoods, black and brown neighborhoods that were actually the ones that were cut through when the highways came through in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, right? And we need to rectify that in our struggles. And the fight to reverse climate change and mitigate its effects ultimately requires us to rethink and remake the form and function of our infrastructure and built environment as well. And struggles in the workplace will also be key to winning social and economic justice. And we are seeing what could be the return of labor militancy with the inspiring teacher strike wave this spring that spread across Trump country and showed that the strike is still the workers' most powerful weapon. And while Trump's constant attacks and the rise of the right may be disheartening, more people, particularly young people, are considering themselves socialists at any time in the last 40 years, which means that we have a huge opportunity to help build a strong socialist current within the broader left. capable of engaging with the terrain of struggle at the moment and pointing to the ultimate goal of winning a socialist world. And that means being able to argue for a world where workers across the globe collectively decide how our world should be run. And part of that is the collective shaping of our built environments and infrastructure systems to serve us and not the bosses. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.